Hello and welcome to Conversations in Cleantech, the podcast that celebrates the cleantech industry and the people that power it, brought to you by Brightsmith. For our seventh season, we're speaking to cleantech leaders about the process of investing in a cleaner planet, from inspiring stories and words of wisdom to financial forecast and investment insights. You can learn all about the people and companies who are driving these investments and propelling us towards a cleaner, greener tomorrow. I'm your regular host, Jenny Gladman, but this season there's a twist. I'll be taking a few months off to have my second baby. So I'm handing the reins of our podcast over to a series of fellow Brightsmithers who will be season 7's super co-hosts. So without further hesitation,
with a talent for aligning strategies with evolving business needs, Raj has co-founded and executed growth strategies for Fortune 70 companies, generating multi-million dollar profitability. His expertise spans multiple industries, driving sufficient transformations across industries. Throughout his career, Raj has led a transformation of business models, including transitioning B2B distribution to SaaS and D2C services, resulting in higher margin and decreased network capital. He boasts an MBA in corporate finance and strategy, certifications, and a corporate directorship in business analytics from Harvard. Currently, Raj holds the position of CFO at EVCS, a scale-up organization that are leading the charge for EV infrastructure across the West Coast, and who knows, probably the USA.
So Raj, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, happy we can make this work. Obviously, we've been talking for a while, so I've been excited about this conversation. So look, as we mentioned before, I put quite a bit of work into making sure I did you justice in your introduction, but let's give our audience a bit more of your background, if you don't mind.
This is my second stint into the climate space. And with that, you know, why the second stint? Why didn't it start there? Why didn't, how did this come about? It really came about from my first entry into the market, where somebody actually took a chance on me. They took the risk to bring someone in who didn't have industry experience, but had the wherewithal to learn and be open to learning about things where they could apply prior experience, prior scars to help a startup grow. And through that process, as I was working with Eyeglass, which is the company where I first got into this market, to quantify the impact for businesses that they could actually have a return on investment by adopting a climate-related technology to save them on CapEx and operating expenses was fascinating to me. My initial assumptions were that it was always going to be a net cost. It is a good thing to do. The financial returns were not as high, or maybe were my initial assumptions. And I was so pleasantly surprised to be wrong on that assumption.
Okay.
Because when a CFO actually sits down, puts pencil to paper and does the math, and then you have the conversation with a potential buyer of the solution, and you sit with their CFO, CFO to CFO, and you say, this math actually works. That's a different conversation to have. And so that got me excited that there is potential. The innovation is happening in this space. And that attracted me back into the space.
So, you know, at Brightsmith, our strap line is live your purpose. You know, we try and have that across our business internally and externally. So you actually already touched on a couple of things there around the, you know, the fascination about the sector. But, you know, how would you summarize that you're currently living your purpose? And, you know, that can be at work or unwork related, if you like.
Purpose, you know, it was one of those, when you start out in your career, it's a novel idea to say, I want to really live my purpose. But at that young age, I didn't really have a sense for what that was. It was really about, I need to get a job. I need to make a living. I didn't start with that initial sense of purpose. And then over the years, you know, I think it depends on, as people mature over time, people start to feel, is it really worth doing? But then I did ask myself, what is really worth doing? Before I joined EVCS, my family had decided that we were going to switch from combustible engine cars to EVs. And we made the switch. My wife made the switch first, actually, and she loved it. And then I started driving the car more, which meant I loved it too. And so we both made the switch. So we decided, hey, this is a lifestyle change that we can feel good about. And being a CFO, the economics made sense. You know, you're spending $16 to $18 to recharge a car versus spending today anywhere from $70 to $80 to fill up a tank of gas every week. the math works. I don't have the maintenance. I don't have any of that. So once we made that family lifestyle change, when this opportunity presented itself, it gave me the opportunity to think about, well, yeah, there is a need, because I'm an EV driver, there is a need for charging on the roads. And then why aren't there more? What can we do to change that? And then you start to read about the changes in policy across the states, then the federal government, and it makes it conducive for you can actually do something that's good for our society and our economy in making that transition. Is it going to be easy? No, but we now have factors that are not working against us, but working with us.
And we can come on to a bit of that later, but I can imagine it's quite a, is it quite a brave step for someone in finance to sort of take a bit of a bet on that? Or, you know, like you said, you've used the words, you know, the math works out quite a lot. I'm curious, did you have any concerns when coming into the sector?
I think with any company that's in a new space, whether it be in the climate space or you're in technology or anywhere else, you're evaluating whether that business can survive. Are you able to move from minimum viable product to truly scale up the business? That's where most startups fail. They can't cross that chasm. It's too big of a leap for many of the companies that are startups. I think the stat is, you know, 90% of startups fail. We hear about the very successful ones, but most of them don't survive. And they don't survive because the true unit economics of that business needs to work long term. Can it truly grow and sustain itself well into the future? And that is the risk that anyone coming into the space has to think through.
So as we look at the space, you know, and obviously you're front and center with the EV charging and obviously as part of that, the energy transition with EVCS. So, you know, I'd like to, if we sort of look, you know, larger scale, in your view, outside of the obvious, what's the reason that EV charging is pivotal to the sort of macro energy transition? Apart from people need to charge cars, they need to get from A to B. But
the cars is a big piece of that transition, right? It's, we can get into the chicken or the egg situation, which is what's been talked about in the industry. But I don't think there's a real answer to what's needed first. It has to be both. And what are the two things? One, consumers are adopting EVs. That's just a fact. Is it not going at a certain percentage rate as forecasted? Well, forecasts can be wrong. But it is happening. The data is there to support that there is a growth in market share of EVs across the country year over year for the last few years. And it continues. That's number one. Number two is that the infrastructure is also growing. But it's not growing at a fast enough pace that consumers want. What can we do about that? And that is the problem we're trying to solve, is how do we scale the network for the benefit of consumers? Because making charging accessible to all is going to accelerate the transition. The excuses go away.
And obviously EVCS specifically, you know, can you talk a bit about, you know, your edge in the market or your competitive edge against, you know, the other, don't need to talk about specifically competitors, but, you know, how are you guys specifically making a difference in that world?
You know, our mission, our vision really is EV charging for all, which means we have to find a way to be the most cost-effective, reliable network that is out there. And by doing that, we're solving an infrastructure problem, we're solving a reliability problem, we're solving an availability problem. And to us, that by far is the winning solution. Our competition is doing what they feel is best. But we believe we're solving the really hard problem of ensuring that what we put out there is reliable.
As we talk to a number of organizations in the space, uptime is seems to be the topic of interest. And I know that wasn't necessarily there previously. So that's
true.
That's great to hear.
True. Uptime is super critical, right? I think it's a fundamental thing that the analogy would be, if you go to the gas station and the pump didn't work, well, that doesn't solve the consumer problem, right? It needs to work when they show up. They need to know that it's available and it will work when they show up. And that is what we're focusing on, is to make sure that when we do deploy technology into the market, that it works. Are we perfect? No, we are not perfect. We are definitely on the path to getting to being very reliable. and that is a core focus of our business.
Yeah, I imagine it's quite a fragile time, you know, from a conversation perspective. You know, we don't necessarily want that narrative of, you know, the charger didn't work, or I got caught somewhere because I couldn't find, you know, working charger, etc. So I can imagine that from a consumer perspective is critical. If we could sort of jump back to your career, we're very big on the fact that, you know, by sharing stories, you know, mentorship comes of that. And someone once said to me that it's always easy to think senior people have always been senior and kind of forget that there was a road that led them there. You know, as you look back over your career, you know, what have been some of the stretch moments where you've really kind of made a jump? And that doesn't need to necessarily be, you know, within the clean tech sector.
Embracing the unknown. We don't have all the answers, but being open to what's possible. In the finance space, we tend to be a risk-averse lot of people.
Right.
We like certainty, which in startups is never there.
Okay.
but being open to the possibility of things are going to go wrong. We don't have all the answers, but how do you learn and lean on people who can help keep you informed to help make good decisions that have a probability of success? It's not certain or uncertain. It's on a continuum of probabilities. How do you then manage that risk? It's easy to do the spreadsheet exercise, but at the end of the day, we're in the business of people. And the business is only going to be as good as the group of people you bring together that can work well together. There will be times of misalignment. There will be times where we need to do some realignment in what we're doing. And ensuring that you, not just the individual going into it, but the team understands that we have to work together and that we have to lean on everyone's strengths, know the weaknesses, right? It's okay. Nobody's perfect in all aspects, but actually know where the weaknesses lie and provide support, right? How do we support a team member's specific weakness? The analogy I'll say football, which is English football, not US football. The team is no weaker than any individual player on their own, but collectively they're a strong unit. So the forward by themselves can do nothing if the midfielders are not getting them the ball. The goalie is useless without the defense. So it has to be a team effort, but each person has their role and it has to be played really well. And the team needs to understand where everybody is. So to me, along the way, moving up from the analyst to the manager to having more people being part of that organization, understanding that at the end of the day, it's the leadership's role to ensure that the team can function effectively as the coach on the sideline, not on the field, is super critical, because it's the players on the field who are making it happen. It's not the coach on the sideline.
A wise lady, I won't mention her name, once said to me, she's going to select opportunity based on who she feels she can have the bad days with. Right. I think that's always kind of stuck with me, and like, you know, evaluating that from that perspective, you know, looking at that, is that when you've made some of your moves, is that's obviously been, you know, key in your decision making, obviously, or part, at least a large part of it, is it?
It is. Understanding where the team dynamics are is now a critical aspect of what I'm trying to evaluate. I need to be able to work with my colleagues at the level that we need to be able to have tough and difficult discussions. If we can't have that, I won't be successful, and they won't be successful, and the investors won't be successful. So it is really important that we're able to have open, transparent discussions, even with the board. Even at the board level, we need to be able to have the tough discussions, because things aren't always ideal. And being able to have those discussions and have the confidence to have those discussions is important. And that just came from learning to, how do you communicate bad news? I think as a finance person, we always love communicating great news. But when we have to share bad news, it's real hard. It's emotionally taxing. And there's a lot to learn from having experience on sharing bad news, not just within your team, but with stakeholders, and seeing what we can do about it. Not just share the bad news, but what can we do about it? And that's a lot that especially people in finance can learn from, is, or anyone really for that matter, things don't always go perfect. How do you learn from bad news and failures? How do you communicate that? And how do you take that to build on and into the future?
I know from our listeners' perspective, you know, they're not all going to be from finance. A lot of them are going to be within the sector. So I'd love if you could give us a glimpse into your kind of day to day and you know how you would refine your responsibilities in EVCS. And I'm sure you're wearing a few hats, given that, you know, given where you are on your evolution scale. But yeah, I'd love to know how you define your day to day.
A few hats is being kind.
Okay.
There may. I wouldn't say being kind, it's being simplistic. There are multiple right. hats that we're wearing. In a there small team, we often wear many hats. The challenge for us is to ensuring that we ensure we have time for ourselves to prioritize. There's going to be a fire that we cannot put out. There are so many fires that come up in a small company as we're growing that everything doesn't have the same heat intensity or impact. It is a fire, but it might be one that I need to let burn. It could be people related. It could be technology related. It could be business process related. It could be strategy related. It could be how we're communicating things in the market. A variety of aspects, right? They all are, many of these are interrelated, but being able to ensure you set aside time to prioritize, is this really something I need to be on top of? And how can I use this as a coaching moment for the team to step up and make those calls? Small teams are a great environment to help people develop that leadership and management skill set for when the company scales, because they've now been able to learn things that they may not be able to learn in a very large company, where they have specific structure and formats and processes that's within their function, that they don't go out of those lanes. But for us, it's okay if someone is involved in other cross-functional areas. We have a core area, but you can always help out. You can participate, you can engage, you can learn. And you can also help firefight in some instances.
That comes down to a more of a competency in the person than an expertise skill set, right? Are they
correct?
Are they able to, you know,
stretch themselves,
succeed in that kind of environment?
Yeah. I love the word competencies, because you may have heard the cliche, what got you here won't take you into the future, especially in startups that are scaling up. It is true. You know, we have to evolve from an area where we have a few people doing everything to now where you start to introduce structure and processes. There is a shift. But the number of fires actually increases, not just in the linear scale, it's a log scale. The complexities increase. And it's important that the team understands and has the mindset and the clarity to be able to make effective decisions when we're not present. So what happened when you're a five-person team? You can easily connect and discuss a line and move forward. In a 50-person team, that's quadrillions of potential communication patterns. That won't work. So how do you make that transition? That's super important. And that's where I'll tie it back to your initial question. When we're doing this as a company, it's super important that when you wear multiple hats, that you're also allowing the team to learn from that decision process so that it doesn't have to be repeated. They're learning through that and they're starting to say, oh, I know how to make this decision. Given a framework, and no matter what I decide, it's going to be good for the company.
So actually really empowering people to be able to make that decision is key. As we kind of bridge the talent gap in for the sake of this conversation, clean tech, we are going to see more and more, and hopefully see more and more people come in from external sectors, you know, specifically looking at, you know, a first time CFO who's in a more traditional, let's say, sector, maybe even a startup sector, you know, what would be some of your, the top three areas of coaching that you'd make sure you gave that person before bringing them into the innovative world of a clean tech startup from, let's say, a more traditional industry?
The first I would start with is take your time to listen in the first 30 days, because there's going to be a lot that you don't know. And listening with the mindset of, what are the consistent areas that I'm hearing from the team that need improvement? Two, can I have an impact on it? If not, what does the what should the organization be considering to have an impact on it? And three, build trust, not just with the C-level team, but with the board as well. You need to earn and build the trust with the C team and the board quickly. And that comes through the interactions. It comes through understanding really what's not working well, what's working well, and where do we want to go. You'll notice I didn't say anything about financials or process or...
No, it's just this was going to say, yeah.
Those are table stakes. You're going to have to do, you have to do that. But if I had to move three things to the top of your list, it's really about the people who you're going to be working with and in the trenches, because you've decided, both the company and you have decided that this is a relationship we want to engage in. And this is your first time in, which means if you haven't come into this space, you're going to be learning a lot. You're going to be learning a lot of language, a lot of policy, a lot of new processes, which process in any company, I would say, yes, you have to learn. But in the climate space, you're learning a lot about policy. It has a material impact on what we can or cannot do. But most important, you're going to be learning more about the team you're working with. And for you to be effective, not just for yourself to be effective and successful, you also want the team to be successful. And so that listening time frame is critical, 30, 60, 90 days, very critical to ensuring that you take everything in without a filter. Just take it all in and then sort through that.
So I can imagine as well the stage that you're coming in at, you know, you are coming in, you know, at the table, but you're coming in at a later stage usually, you know, with these firms. So I can imagine, yeah, that's, you know, being the new kid on the block coming in, and, you know, can be quite probably tempting to just be throwing around ideas, but, you know, being able to understand the state of play and how that's sort of laid out is probably quite key, which again leans into that competency piece. So now I think that's really interesting.
I mean, to build on what you just brought up, it's really about understanding where is the mindset of the team. Understanding that is critical. What is the mindset that we need to be? Where does the company mindset need to be in 3 to 5 years? Do we have a gap? You won't know that coming in, but where are we today is what the CFO needs to understand. And that's going to help give the CFO the foundation to say, do we have a path to get there? If not, how do I work with the executive team to figure that out? Because you're brought in at a point where the company needs to scale up. Typically, that's when companies are bringing in CFOs. And it's how do we then allocate the capital, which is a core function of our job, but how do we ensure there's capital assigned to ensuring we can scale up with the right people, process, and most critical part, competencies and mindset.
And all while still showing immense enthusiasm for the mission, the journey, and the that piece at the
Absolutely.
Same time.
Absolutely, that
I'm sure isn't in conflict
at all. That is foundational. That is foundational. It's always hard. If everything was working, they probably wouldn't need you, unfortunately. But that doesn't mean everything is broken. There are many things that work just perfectly fine for where the company is. The question is the company ready for the change? And if they're not, that's your journey. How do you start help the company make that journey and make it successful for everyone?
As we sort of look into the investment side of the marketplace specifically, are there any kind of, you know, we know we've talked about, you know, policy, and we know about all of the government incentives that are, and we know about obviously California specifically and their mission within EV charging. But are there any kind of headwinds that investors or, you know, generally investment in the industry is wary of, or you believe should be wary of?
The headwinds really come from understanding, do the unit economics for what, and forget EV charging, just the sector in general, do the unit economics really work? We must have a very honest discussion and evaluation with ourselves to say, it may not work today because the technology is in early stage, but is there a path in the future where we can actually make the unit economics work? And do we control it? Do we control that portion of it, or can we make decisions that can influence the economics of what we're putting into the market? And that's what we have to evaluate. If we're in the early stage development and we're truly the innovative space, that's a high risk investment. So you definitely want to ensure your investor base
has that high risk appetite that it might not work out. I shouldn't even say might not work out. It's likely not going to work out. There's low probability of success and low probability of return. But if it works, the return is going to be massive. So ensuring you have clear alignment on that risk return profile with your investor base is critical. You definitely want to ensure you have an understanding of what's your investor return timeframe, right? If it's the typical 3 to 5 year return in our space in the clean tech, that's probably misaligned, which is where I see some headwinds, where we have investors who have come into the space thinking that, yeah, we're going to be able to get a return in 3 to 5 years, but that wasn't communicated necessarily with the company. The company probably understood that they have maybe 7 to 10 years of runway to make it work. And that's where the headwinds are coming up, where the funding sources have relied on low cost of money or low cost of borrowing. And now we're in a changed policy environment, you know, monetary policy environment, where it's very expensive and they're getting called on the funds, they're getting called on the money invested. And that can complicate the execution of the company, because it's not that the company is doing anything wrong. It's just misalignment on investment philosophy. I would say many startups, unfortunately, throwing the baby out with the bathwater here, in the last 7 years, there was an investment mindset that profits didn't matter. And unfortunately, that drives behaviors that are very hard to pivot from in a very short time frame. So my earlier point of staying focused on the unit economics and having a path to get there is the fundamental approach to creating value for investors and consumers. Sticking to that is going to help you stay away, not have to worry about market headwinds. If that strategy is right, you're going to succeed. It's going to be harder to find the right investors, but nonetheless, because you're focused on the right thing of value creation for investors, you're going to get an investor. It's just going to take a little longer.
Imagine that shifts the internal dialogue that you're having as a team. You know,
it does
quite considerably. Yeah,
yeah, it does. It does, absolutely, because instead of just focusing on top line revenue growth, you're making sure that everybody understands the impact all the way down to the bottom line. Now, it's not that we're not going to invest in innovation or invest in areas where there is risk. No, we're going to do it in a balanced way, but it's not we're going to go after everything. Or the phrase that's been used, it's not a land grab. It's really selective, but we're still focused on growth.
And what needs to be front of mind for a first-time founder, you know, very early stage out there, kind of drumming up investment? What kind of things do you think they need to have front of mind to make sure that they're attractive in what probably sounds like quite a much more competitive landscape, and definitely that's probably under a bit of a microscope as well?
I think take a microscope to the unit economics. Be absolutely brutal with the assumptions that you're putting forward, right? If you don't have the process in place and it's just at the concept stage, be absolutely brutal with your assumptions to say, is this real or is it a fantasy? Go down to that. Be super critical of your idea. Separate yourself from it, because you can be really attached to an idea, but then when you start doing the math, it doesn't pencil out. Investors are very, very selective today on where they're going to be deploying money, especially today. Since I would say mid last year, up until now, the investments in industry has gone back to what I would call risk-adjusted investments. So they're going to put a critical eye to that, to your proposal or your concept, before they decide to invest. But the core unit economics have to work. How are you truly going to hold yourself accountable to that? It needs to be abundantly clear to the investors that they can turn around and hold you accountable to.
That was really helpful. Thank you. So as we come to a close, I think, you know, my last question would be, you know, what's exciting you most about the EV charging sector, EVCS, the market in general? You know, I'll leave that nice and open to you, but what lights you up at the moment?
The potential for having an impact in California, Oregon, and Washington, which is where EVCS focuses today, the opportunity to have an impact is immense. We the team has put in immense hard work to truly grow our business. We doubled last year. We're going to grow again this year. We have been recently awarded several grants across the three states. It's public. You'll see it in the news. We've got over $100 million in grants that we've been awarded, which is a daunting number when I sit back and look at it based on where we were. That's a lot of work to do, which, you know, I haven't been able to say this in prior organizations, but we have to do a lot of work in a very short amount of time. That's exciting. It's a little unnerving, but nonetheless, we have great partners in the market, investors, partners in the market who are all coming to the table because they see the fundamentals of the business are real and that we can have a real impact. To me, that's really exciting. We have an area that we're going to grow. We're going to grow into very well into the future. We're in a situation where the market, where we're positioned, and now how we're getting financing is going to be great timing for us. And that's an exciting place to be in.
Especially when you've got a great squad around you, because you've...
Absolutely.
That's been without part the team, of your analysis.
Without the team, none of this can happen. And so we need to be... We're working on driving more alignment, fixing processes, setting ourselves up to be truly scalable. And that's the exciting part of where we are.
Raj, this has been a really nice conversation. I've really enjoyed it. And I think you've given our listeners a great glimpse into you, EVCS, and the market in general. I really appreciate you taking the time. Thank you.
Thanks, Ben. This is great.